regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. For those who are asking, yes, Bentley, the Bernese Mountain Dog, is doing okay. Had to take him to the vet yesterday, as I mentioned on the show. He had like a hot spot pop up and very short period of time. I had to take him to the vet on Friday for another unrelated issue that was taken care of. And then Sunday afternoon, I noticed his face was all jacked up. So took him to the vet yesterday, and he is doing better. He's in a cone. And I have determined that peanut butter is not the best pill delivery mechanism for Bentley. Cheese, on the other hand, cheese sticks in particular, that gets the job done. So, yeah, I think he's going to be feeling better. But unfortunately, that took up so much of my day yesterday. I didn't have a chance to get any guests for today's show. So we are going guestless. You will be my company today. We'll get back to the conversation, as opposed to the monologue, on tomorrow's program. But there actually is a lot to talk about, particularly what's going on Capitol Hill. While the Supreme Court is away for its summer recess, the House is busy working on many budget bills. And in fact, there's quite a bit of Second Amendment language contained within some of these appropriations measures. So NRA's Institute for Legislative Action laid out some of the good language that we are seeing in some of these bills here. They note that the Military Construction, Veterans Affairs, and Related Agencies bill includes a prohibition on the use of funds to allow the Department of Veterans Affairs from transmitting a veteran to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System solely on the basis that such a veteran has been appointed a fiduciary to manage their benefits. That legislation actually passed the House last month and still needs to be approved by the Senate. Now, that's an existing rider. We've seen that in the past, but this language, again, will remain in effect, likely remain in effect. I don't see the Senate objecting to this. And, you know, this is something we saw back in the Obama administration, right? The idea that, well, if you've got a fiduciary appointed to manage your affairs, then, yeah, you're mentally defective. You shouldn't be able to own a firearm. And I'm willing to say that there may be some individuals who have had a fiduciary appointed to them who are unable to exercise their Second Amendment rights. They have been adjudicated as mentally ill, but that's not the case for everybody who's had a fiduciary appointed. And what the Obama administration tried to do is basically take a shortcut and say, well, if you've had that fiduciary appointed, that is the equivalent. That amounts to a judicial determination that you are mentally defective and you have lost your right to keep and bear arms. So it is good to see that language has survived. Also, the Interior Environment and Related Agencies bill includes a prohibition of funds for the EPA to regulate the lead content of ammunition, ammunition components, or fishing tackle under the Toxic Substances Control Act. This has, again, been something that gun control activists have been pushing for a long time because they believe that they can use that act to ban lead ammunition outright. As the Institute for Legislative Action points out, this bill also contains a provision to protect recreational activities and access on public lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management, as well as the Forest Service. That legislation, scheduled for a markup later today. In fact, the markup may be taking place by the time you see this. And again, that's really important, right? I mean, we saw the attempt by Senator Mike Lee to actually sell off a bunch of public land in the reconciliation bill with that money going to supposedly going to build affordable housing. Now, that measure was removed, but access to public land, particularly for shooting, is still very much a concern for gun owners, particularly in Western states. You know, east of the Mississippi, it's a little bit different. There's not nearly as much BLM managed land, but you get out to states like Nevada, Arizona, Utah, we are talking about vast tracts of property. And in some cases, that may be the only place, or at least certainly the closest place, where gun owners can safely and responsibly shoot. So preserving that access, again, is critically important to protecting our Second Amendment rights. Institute for Legislative Action also says the Commerce, Justice, Science, and Related Agencies bill includes a prohibition on the use of funds to impose a ban on imported shotguns, a prohibition on the use of any funds to maintain any record on multiple rifle or shotgun sales to an individual, a prohibition on the use of funds to arbitrarily deny importation of qualifying curio and relic firearms, and a prohibition on the use of funds to require an export license for all small or for small firearm parts valued at less than $500 for export to Canada. That legislation also considered for markup later today. The Defense Appropriations Bill has a prohibition on the use of funds to destroy surplus firearms or spend brass. That was approved by the House Appropriations Committee last month. It's awaiting a vote on the House floor. And again, this is a measure that the Biden administration tried to enact, particularly with the spend brass, right? And again, is this a direct assault on the Second Amendment? Does if that prohibition did not exist, would our right to keep arms be eradicated? No. But would it be more difficult for reloaders to engage in that activity? Yes. Would it increase the cost of ammunition? Yes. And is that what gun control advocates want? Sure. I mean, it's not their end game. But until they can eradicate the right to keep your arms, they will certainly take anything that will annoy, harass, or impede the ability to exercise our Second Amendment rights. The Energy and Water Development and Related Agencies Bill includes a prohibition on the use of funds to implement or enforce regulations that prevent the carrying of firearms on property managed by the Army Corps of Engineers. That was scheduled for a subcommittee markup yesterday. I believe that language survived the markup process. And the National Security Department of State and Related Programs Bill includes a prohibition on the use of funds to implement the UN Arms Trade Treaty. That is also scheduled for a subcommittee markup today. And again, a lot of this language has been in place, at least while Republicans have been in control of Congress. But these protections are pretty important. Now, you're not going to be able to advance policy, unfortunately, through the budgetary process, right? So you can't get national right to carry reciprocity, for example, through a budget bill. You can't get the entirety of the Hearing Protection Act, or the Short Act, or the Rifle Act, or any other pro-gun legislation attached to one of these budget bills. So most of what we're seeing here, I would say, kind of nibbling around the edges of protecting our Second Amendment rights, right? Keeping the status quo in place as opposed to advancing the Second Amendment. But there is one measure that's pretty interesting. We talked about this. Actually, I wrote about this at Bearing Arms this morning. Firearms Policy Coalition pointed out that in the funding bill for the Justice Department, there is language that would specifically keep the $1.2 billion appropriated to the ATF within the ATF. It could not be used. Those funds could not be used for any other agency. So Trump administration wants to merge the Drug Enforcement Agency and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. That language would make it, if not impossible to do so, very, very difficult to do so. And that merger would have to be signed off by Congress anyway. So I think this is a signal to the Trump administration that, listen, those plans to merge these two agencies aren't going anywhere. There's not enough support on Capitol Hill for that. As we've talked about with Second Amendment groups, with individuals like Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, nobody can really say who's in favor of this merger. Other than, again, maybe, you know, managers in the and administrators in the Trump administration. But Second Amendment groups don't like the idea of a bigger, broader agency that could be weaponized against gun owners in the Second Amendment. Gun control activists don't like the idea because they see that the ATF would be weakened if the DEA and the ATF were to be merged together. And I mean, I got to say, like, that might be true in the short term. But again, the next time there's a Democrat in the White House, you've got the ATF on steroids, right? And that is why I think there is some genuine concern and real pushback to this idea on Capitol Hill. One of the other provisions, though, of this bill, the funding bill for DOJ, which would include funding for ATF, states that if the NFA processing times get to be problematic, that the agency's budget would be cut by 60%, could be cut by up to 60%. So the $1.2 billion that has been appropriated to the ATF, down from $1.6 billion, I believe, last fiscal year, could be cut to as little as $480 million if the paper applications for NFA transfers start taking more than 120 days to process, if the electronic transfers start taking more than 60 days to process, budget cuts would be levied against the ATF. I think it's interesting. Now, I expect, by the way, the ATF's going to push back on this. We may see some pushback from DOJ, with the argument being that, okay, listen, if we don't have the staffing to process NFA paperwork in a timely manner, you're going to make matters worse by gutting our staffing, right? So if you want to fix the issue, you would need to hire more staff. I suggested at Bearing Arms, maybe instead of slashing the budget, maybe the ATF could be forced to reallocate resources to NFA approval. So we would see, you know, fewer field agents, maybe fewer investigations in inspections of FFLs, so that the agency could fulfill its duty to process these NFA applications in a timely manner. Now, as things stand right now, ATF's doing it's well within that timeline. I think the average for a paper application is 48 days to approve. For written, or excuse me, for electronic applications, I believe for an individual, it's 13 days on average. For a trust, it's 9 days on average. So the ATF at the moment could comply with that standard. What would happen, though, if there's a glut of applications, as I suspect there will be on January the 1st, right, when these NFA taxes get zeroed out on suppressors, short-barrel firearms, any other weapons? I think we're going to see a surge of applications there. And I wouldn't be surprised if that does lead, at least in the short term, to longer wait times before these applications are approved. I, based on what the numbers are right now, I don't think that we'll see those delays triple, right, from, you know, 48 days to 150 days, something like that. But I could see it going from 48 days to 60, 70 days, again, depending on how many of us take advantage of the zero taxes on these NFA items. That language, again, subject to markup, subject to amendments. And I do think there's going to be some pushback from DOJ on the language that would keep the ATF's budget confined to the ATF. I think we'll see some pushback from the ATF on the language that would cut the funding even further if they cannot abide by the NFA. But as I said at Bearing Arms, I think, you know, the good thing is that the intention behind this language is to protect and safeguard our Second Amendment rights and to make it easier, frankly, to exercise our Second Amendment rights. And if the NFA, or excuse me, if the ATF starts playing games with the NFA, then there should be consequences. I just don't want to see those consequences end up hurting gun owners as much or more than it hurts the ATF, right? I think anything that any punishment that's leveled needs to be felt by the agency and not by the lawful gun owners in this country. So we'll keep our eyes on all of these appropriations bills. You know, again, it's good that we don't have to worry at this point about any poison pill amendments. I'm sure Democrats are going to try to attach some. But this is a different process than what we saw when Democrats were in control of Congress, when, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars given to gun control groups under the guise of, you know, community violence intervention programs. Again, the ATF weaponized into essentially a gun control group with law enforcement powers. Those days are behind us, at least for now, knock on wood. And hopefully that will be the case for years to come. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Chicago. Man on gun probation charged with North Side robbery spree. Yeah, a 19-year-old, by the way, who is not allowed to possess a handgun in Illinois, who is on probation for possessing a firearm, and then not just possessing a firearm. Tyson Adams was on probation for possessing a firearm on the Chicago Transit Authority, which is a gun-free zone. It's a gun-free zone, by the way, that's being challenged by the Firearms Policy Coalition, a case called the Schoenthal versus Raul. And a district court judge has granted an injunction, at least for the named plaintiffs in this case, saying that their rights are being violated since they cannot carry lawfully on public transportation in Chicago. Now, why would you want to carry lawfully on public transportation in Chicago? I'm guessing because of guys like Tyson Adams. Violent criminals know that this gun-free zone is a target-rich environment. We see shootings, assaults, sexual assaults all the time on Chicago Transit Authority property. It's gotten to the point that, honestly, I don't really even cover all of the stories that I see. I've written up maybe a dozen or so stories over the past couple of years. But you can only, you know, provide so much coverage. So I don't really even write about this at Bearing Arms because these crimes are so common in this gun-free zone. Anyway, in this case, Tyson Adams arrested yesterday, one of two offenders who allegedly carried out a string of gunpoint robberies while driving a white car. CWB Chicago reports that Adams now faces three felony counts of armed robbery with a firearm, one felony count of attempted armed robbery. Court records show that Adams was sentenced to 2 years of first-time weapons offender probation in February, just a few months ago, after he was caught with a gun at the Roosevelt CTA station last summer. CWB Chicago reports that since February, he's been arrested three more times, once for the current felony robbery charges, twice last month for misdemeanor offenses. CWB Chicago reports that records also indicate that Adams failed to appear in court for one of those misdemeanor cases on June 27th, prompting the judge in that case to ask their clerk to send Adams a postcard reminder. Didn't send out a warrant or issue a warrant to take him into custody for violating the terms of his probation. Nope. We'll send him a postcard. Hey, don't forget to show up for your next court appearance. I'm just guessing here, since Adams was allegedly caught in possession of a firearm and allegedly committed a string of armed robberies, he didn't forget about his court hearing. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that maybe Adams just willfully ignored the fact that he was supposed to show up in court. And again, why not? You know, you break the law, you carry a gun into a gun-free zone. What happens to you? Well, if you're a 19-year-old in Chicago, slap on the wrist. Now, if you are a lawful concealed carry holder, you could have that license revoked. You may be looking at jail time. And again, for those of us who aren't violent criminals, that's a big deal. So the gun-free zone in Chicago that denies people the ability to carry on public transportation doesn't stop violent offenders. It stops those of us who want to protect ourselves against those violent offenders on public transportation. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. Headline from Chico, California. Chico man not charged with homicide in campground shooting claims self-defense. Claims, by the way, that the prosecutors have essentially accepted. KRCR in Chico, Redding, California, says that no homicide charges were filed against a Chico man involved in a deadly shooting after investigators and prosecutors concluded that he had a reasonable self-defense claim. So it wasn't just that he claimed a self-defense. According to the TV station, the case stems from a shootout, essentially, at the Chico homeless alternative camping site last week between 51-year-old Gerald Michael Thompson and 53-year-old Donald Leroy Stevens, both residents of that camping site. Stevens was shot and killed. The Butte County DA's office shared the findings of an investigation. They said that the Chico police detectives initially investigated the death as a possible homicide. They interviewed a number of transient residents of the camping site. They learned that Thompson and Stevens resided in neighboring tents and that one of Thompson's dogs had attacked one of Stevens' dogs earlier in the day. There were multiple witnesses who confirmed that Stevens was very upset, was yelling that he was going to kill Gerald Michael Thompson, Thompson's dogs, and Thompson's family, while racking the action of a sawed-off shotgun at his tent, which was directly across from Thompson's tent. Witnesses say that Thompson retrieved a .22 caliber revolver from his tent, went out to meet Stevens, both men pointing their guns at each other. Stevens continuing to yell that he was going to kill Thompson. Thompson told Stevens to calm down and not shoot. Police say another third party attempted to intervene during the standoff, and seeing that Stevens was the primary aggressor, reached for the shotgun in Stevens' hand. Thompson told police that it was at that point that Thompson saw a motion out of the corner of his eye, saw Stevens flinching. He said that caused him to reflectively squeeze the trigger of his gun in the belief that he was about to be shot. Fired one round, saw Stevens drop to the ground. Thompson then fled the camping site, but was found and arrested 3 days later by Chico police officers. Butte County DA Mike Ramsey said under California law, self-defense is justified when an individual who's not the initial aggressor reasonably believes that they're in imminent danger of being killed or suffering great bodily injury. When an individual holds that reasonable belief, they may then use sufficient force to prevent that danger. Ramsey said, though, to defeat a claim of self-defense, the prosecution must first disprove that claim beyond a reasonable doubt. He said multiple people, including Thompson, told detectives that Stevens was known to be dangerous and irrational when he was upset, that Stevens had threatened other people before, and that Stevens had ammunition for the shotgun. Thompson said they discussed it in the past. Stevens had shown Thompson the shotgun and ammunition in the past. So Thompson, again, had a reasonable belief that he was about to be shot, and he's not charged with Stevens' death, but he is facing charges. He was arrested and charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm due to his 2021 felony conviction for possessing brass knuckles. That's a felony in California. He was also convicted of a misdemeanor charge of possessing a concealed firearm in that same 2021 case. When he was arrested recently, he initially lied about his name to officers, and then when searched, was found to be in possession of methamphetamine. So he's also been charged with misdemeanor counts of giving a false name to officers and drug possession. Thompson told detectives after he was arrested that he fled the scene due to Stevens' known ties to Nazi and white supremacist groups, saying that he feared if he was imprisoned, he would suffer retaliation for shooting Stevens, even if it was in self-defense. I guess that's something that he's going to have to be concerned about going forward. Now, I don't know if it's probably too late to challenge the conviction for possession of brass knuckles, but I think there's a case to be made that California's law making it a felony to possess those items also runs afoul of our Second Amendment rights. But again, you can be a felon in possession of a firearm and still be able to use that firearm in self-defense. Now, again, you're going to get charged with possessing that firearm, but if you legitimately used it in self-defense, you're not going to face, well, you might still face charges, but hopefully you've got an affirmative defense, right? Again, you're not necessarily allowed to possess the gun, but you are allowed to act in self-defense, including with a gun that you're not allowed to own. And that appears to be the case here for Mr. Thompson there in Chico, California. Finally today, our good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Atlanta who helped a police officer arrest an individual who was not just armed, because that's not against the law, but this individual was apparently pointing what turned out to be a BB gun at a MARTA station. We talked about the CTA in Chicago. This is Atlanta's public transportation system. This was last Friday. An officer responded to a Peachtree Street near the Garnett MARTA station on reports of a person in the area pointing a gun at people. When the officer approached the suspect, identified as Harold Sullivan, Sullivan took off. But a good Samaritan saw what was going on, intervened, took Sullivan to the ground, helped secure Sullivan's gun, which again turned out to be a BB gun. Sullivan allegedly hit the officer in the face with that BB gun during the struggle. Sullivan has been charged with battery, aggravated battery, obstructing a police officer, pointing or aiming a pistol at another, disorderly conduct, as well as two counts of simple assault. And according to Atlanta News First, while Atlanta police say they are appreciative of the man's actions, they remind people that the safest way to assist in situations is by calling 911. I mean, if you don't want the public's help, okay, but there may very well be circumstances where that officer is in critical need of a good Samaritan. I don't necessarily think that advice was warranted. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I am looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Don't know who we'll be talking to, but we will be talking to somebody. Lord willing, the creek don't rise, and as long as my dogs continue to stay healthy, That'll be the case. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. Today, though, we're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. I look forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.